Coming up next, Upstate's HealthLink on Air. On tonight's program, we'll discuss migraine headaches, what can trigger them, and what may help.
I usually like to think as triggers as things that push you closer to that threshold. People with migraine, however, will have a much lower threshold.
Plus, we'll continue to talk about raising kids with positive parenting.
That's the other reason we discourage corporal punishment. It teaches children whoever's stronger and bigger than them can control the situation.
And we'll talk to someone who's run an Ebola clinic treatment center in Liberia.
Every patient initially admitted goes to a suspect ward. Mind you, in that suspect ward, you may have people that don't have Ebola, and you also have people that actually have Ebola.
We'll get our checkup from the neck up and hear from our healing muse, and that's all coming up right after the news. This is Upstate Medical University's HealthLink on Air, your weekly dose of information about health and medical issues affecting Central New Yorkers from the region's only academic medical center. I'm your host, Linda Cohen. On tonight's show, we explore what we mean by positive parenting and the slippery slope of discipline. Plus, what running an Ebola clinic is all about. But first, is that nasty headache a migraine, and what should you do about it? In the United States, more than 37 million people suffer from migraines. Some migraine studies estimate that 13% of adults have migraines, and 2 to 3 million migraine sufferers are chronic, causing moderate to severe disability. We'll hear with more on this as Dr. Luis Mexico, professor of neurology and ophthalmology at Upstate Medical University. Welcome, Dr. Mexico. Thanks for coming in.
Glad to be here.
So let's begin by helping our listeners understand, what do we mean when we say migraine? What is a migraine?
So migraine is a very specific form of headache, although interesting, sometimes headache is not a part of it, but we can get to that later, so it's not too confusing. But migraine is a primary headache disorder. In other words, it's a disorder of the brain that is caused by a specific biology that many times we inherit from our parents. And that's why it runs in family as a very prevalent condition. But clearly, it's a disease that has to be tackled by itself. So in other words, trying to figure out what is the cause of migraine sometimes is not useful.
But what is actually happening in the brain to cause a migraine, and how is that different from other headaches?
So in migraine, we have studied its biology, and we understand it as several steps that are happening in the brain. We haven't figured out all the pieces of the puzzle, but clearly there is a component where, for example, the pain originates from the surface of the brain. The surface of the brain, as many people know, is called meninges, and in the meninges we have this system that is where we have blood vessels and we have specific neurons, and it's called the trigeminal vascular system, and that's where a lot of the migraine pain comes from. But then there's central networks. There's networks that go inside the brain, and there's circuits, and it gets fairly complicated. But clearly, you can view it as a cascade of events and eventually as a chemical storm in the brain. That's how I think of it.
So is there actually a swelling or an enlargement of the vessels during that time that create the symptoms?
So the blood vessels in the surface of the brain, not within the brain, vasodilate.
They get bigger.
They get bigger. And then there's release of these chemical substances that irritate the nerve endings on the surface of the brain. And that's why when people have a migraine, it's painful to walk, it's painful to cough, to laugh, to strain, because there is some irritation that is happening on the surface of the brain.
So how is it different? I mean, when we say headache in general, how is this different? I mean, a typical quote-unquote tension headache.
Yeah, so tension-type headache is the most common form of headache. It's what people refer to as common headaches. And those are headaches that usually are not disabling. People can continue to function. There's little associated symptoms beyond the headache. Migraine is different. Migraine headache tends to be described as throbbing, moderate to severe, It may be on one side of the head or both sides of the head. It gets worse with movement. It gets better with rest, and it's associated with other symptoms. People get sensitive to light, to sound. They may feel nauseous. They may even vomit. Sometimes there's other associated symptoms such as dizziness and malaise and decreased appetite. The duration of the headache is defined as a headache that lasts for several hours, and there's specific criteria for that. But let's just say that it's a headache that lasts for several hours, some people have their headache is preceded by other symptoms.
They call the aura.
It's called the aura, exactly. And these are focal neurological symptoms. The most common is the visual aura, where people will see somewhere in their visual field this area that it tends to be shimmering, tends to be, it expands in size, and it lasts for a few minutes, and then it's followed by the headache. Mm-hmm. Other symptoms that may precede headache symptoms is numbness or tingling in various parts of the body. And then there's a recovery phase after the migraine headache is over, where the person may feel tired or drowsy or moody. There are certainly a sort of a post-headache phase. So the entire migraine is preceded by symptoms, then it's followed by headache, and then it's followed by even other more pervasive symptoms.
So who is most at risk for this? What are our typical migraine sufferers looking like?
So migraine sufferers tend to be women. The ratio of women to men is 3-1. They tend to be young adults. Migraines happen during the years of most productive productivity. However, it may happen in children. It may happen in the elderly as well. But it tends to be more common in young adults.
So it can usually occur lifelong.
Yes, migraine certainly can transform itself over the years, sometimes presenting in childhood with symptoms that don't even have headaches. There are very specific syndromes that are most interesting. For example, there's a syndrome where children will have spells of vomiting, and that's all what they have. They just vomit. There are also spells where children may have dizziness, and they see the room spinning and without headache. Then when they're teenagers, maybe they develop a more classical headache syndrome, and then when they're older, they may get less headaches but more visual aura, for example.
So how do you clinically actually diagnose this? Is it just from the symptomatology?
It's just from the symptomatology, and also the feature that these are episodes that repeat over time. So it's difficult sometimes to make the diagnosis based on only one or two or two episodes. But if the person gives a clear history of previous similar episodes, then the diagnosis of migraine is more certain. And then, of course, it's based on a full evaluation where we do physical exam, we look at other contributing factors. There's a whole medical evaluation that goes on.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here with neurologist Dr. Luis Mejico. We're talking about migraines. People often talk about this thing called triggers, because apparently there are things that will cause a migraine to occur. Many people have that experience. Tell us what they are, or what are the common ones, and, how significant are they?
Right. So it is thought that we all have a threshold beyond which we can induce a migraine headache, a migraine-like headache, even on somebody who's never had a headache.
Really?
People with migraine, however, will have a much lower threshold. So I usually like to think as triggers, as things that push you closer to that threshold. So it tends to be multifactorial. So there's a weather storm that is coming. And then I am stressed because of this and that, and I didn't sleep well last night, and then I had a glass of wine. And that all this accumulation of triggers pushed me over that threshold. Other people, however, may have very, very specific triggers that will throw them over that edge, over that threshold, very rapidly. And it is not known what percentage of people is like that, but some people will tell you, if I have a glass of red wine, of white wine, something very specific.
I'm one of those people.
Okay. Or, yes. And if you identify that, then you know to stay away from it.
Exactly.
It's more difficult for the person who has multifactorial elements. You cannot control the weather unless you move to somewhere else.
Right.
But, you know, you may be able to control that glass of alcohol, for example.
Right. So it's important to know those triggers for the individual. That actually leads me into this whole concept of treatment or what you can do about it. Because obviously it can be a very disabling condition, especially for some people who have them chronically, regularly, etc. Because it's, as a migraine sufferer myself, I will say they're painful, quite painful. So I thought we'd start with kind of behavioral things that the patient themselves can do. What are the kinds of things you recommend?
Exactly, and those are very, very important points. Migraine can be extremely disabling, and severe form of migraines have been, considered, for example, by the World Health Organization as being as severe as being quadriplegic. So spinal cord injuries has been a comparison. Thank God not everybody will have severe migraines, but behavioral treatment is extremely important. It's understanding the relationship between triggers and your migraine headaches. Is also understanding where you are in relationship to that threshold. So if you are having a rough week, that may be the time, again, to try to control your environment better. When it comes to behavioral treatment for migraine, it's very important the word regular. You want to have regular meals at regular times, regular exercise, regular sleep, and regular is like the key word here, which is difficult sometimes. We all have busy lives, we all have things to do, and we may skip a meal, and we get a headache.
Or lose sleep or whatever for any number of reasons.
Absolutely.
Right. So that's key. So that's actually empowering the patient to at least have some things they can do. So then how about preventive treatment? Because that's of late become much more well understood, I think, we've had the idea of treating symptoms, which I will get to in a minute in terms of medications and what have you. But there are preventive treatments now that are more available for people, especially those who suffer regular migraine headaches.
That's right. And that's a main criteria is when people are having migraine headaches often. And arbitrarily, we have drawn the line, people that have more than 3 or 4 headaches a month that are disabling, then those people certainly qualify for preventive treatment. Preventive treatment, we are talking about medications, taking something on a daily basis. And the main purpose of the preventive medicine is to make the headaches less frequent, less severe, and lasting less.
So what kinds of medications are most effective, been shown to be most effective?
Right, so we borrow medications primarily from other family of drugs. We borrow medication from anti-seizure family. We borrow medications from anti-blood pressure family and also antidepressants. Those are the main three groups. Then we have a miscellaneous group that also include even over-the-counter agent. There are some minerals, some vitamins, some herbal supplements that have been shown to have some effect on prevention of migraine headaches.
What have you seen to be most effective in terms of medications in your own experience clinically?
So probably the most effective oral medication that we have for prevention of migraine is a drug called topiramate. And topiramate is a medication from the anti-epilepsy group, anti-seizure family. We also have medications that are antidepressants. There's an older family of medication that's called the tricyclic antidepressants that we sometimes use. Now, a very important point about this preventive medicine is that we use low doses. We always start with extremely low doses. So we are not aiming at doses that are used for epilepsy or for hypertension. Always low doses first.
Okay, and then you kind of, it's going to be on a case-by-case basis. It's a little trial and error with the individual patient.
Absolutely.
All right, quickly, in the very little time we have left, what's the most effective treatment for the actual painful symptoms?
So, moderate range migraine can be treated with over-the-counter pain medications, such as ibuprofen, and there's some literature behind those. However, severe migraine headaches are best treated with specific migraine killers, as I call them, instead of painkillers, migraine killers. And we are talking about a family of drugs called triptans, T-R-I-P-T-A-N, triptans. And there's several forms available. And again, there's not one that is better than another one, but they have some specific differences between them, and we choose depending on the circumstances.
So do you, just in the bottom line, do you recommend people come to a neurologist when they have a debilitating issue with migraines?
Well, I believe that care should start with their family practitioner. The general practitioner many times can solve a problem such as migraine. And that person has the best judgment to refer to a neurologist when
and would know when it's necessary.
Exactly.
This has been incredibly enlightening, and as a migraine sufferer, I thank you for it. Very good information. Thank you so much. My guest has been Dr. Luis Mejico, Professor of Neurology and Ophthalmology at Upstate Medical University. Coming up next, what do we mean by positive parenting? You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Upstate's HealthLink on Air, Linda Cohen joining you. Parenting is arguably the hardest job there is. Just ask today's parents, trying to juggle career aspirations, job pressures, economic realities, and raising kids. And there are no easy answers, foolproof formulas, or guidebooks. Here with some answers and some pitfalls to avoid is Dr. Alicia Pekarsky, Assistant Professor of Pediatrics at Upstate Medical University. Dr. Pekarsky is also a board-certified child abuse pediatrician, as well as a general pediatrician at Upstate Golisano Children's Hospital, McMahon Ryan Child Advocacy Center, as well as University Pediatric and Adolescent Center. Welcome, Dr. Pekarsky. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me, Linda.
Well, you were here not too long ago, actually, and we had a wonderful conversation about parenting. And I wanted to bring you back because I wanted to give our listeners an opportunity to listen again to some of these concepts that you call positive parenting. Mm-hmm. And then I have some other topic I'd like to get to after that. So let's review these briefly. What exactly is positive parenting?
I'd say positive parenting is a parent's job in terms of teaching and training their children, showing them that the world can be a safe place, guiding them to make good decisions, and having an appropriate level of self-esteem.
So the idea is you want them to grow up to be hopeful, mm-hmm. to look at the world as hopefully a positive place, something they can be effective in, mm-hmm. and your role is to do it in a positive way.
To demonstrate those principles, yes, and to model that.
Right. So, I mean, how is this different than other concepts in terms of positive parenting?
Well, positive parenting really, we're talking about discipline, which again is teaching and training children, which is very different from punishment, which is inflicting injury to the child, either mentally or physically, and is very counterproductive.
Yeah, I mean, it seems to me that that's where the rubber meets the road when we talk about mm-hmm. discipline. We've got these sometimes very rambunctious, unruly children mm-hmm. who are growing up and trying to learn how they can control the world, their own world, and it often butts up against the so-called rules of either mm-hmm. the home or this classroom or many other things. So it seems to me one of the greatest challenges parents face, and I know I certainly did as well, is how to help that child, guide that child into more adaptive, socially appropriate, and positive behavior in a way that you allow them to maintain their own dignity, so to speak, and self-esteem, but at the same time, you get them to do what you need them to do.
Right, and I think that is the most challenging thing about being a parent, because in addition to doing that, you have to take care of all the other background issues that goes along with having a family. So it can be very stressful for parents when they're dealing with all the other factors in the background.
And you mentioned a minute ago physical punishment, which, you know, it depends on your cultural background. It depends on what part of the country, perhaps, you've come from. And there have been things in the news of late about, you know, using a switch and, mm-hmm. and all this kind of thing. What So this whole notion of the slippery slope about physical punishment, it seems to me it converge on something like abuse.
Right. So because there is a slippery slope, pediatricians in general discourage corporal punishment, using physical discipline for children, because we know that it's a slippery slope and it can slide into child maltreatment very easily. Discipline is meant to be done in a controlled setting. When people are using corporal punishment, they're often acting out of anger.
And they lose, sometimes can really lose control.
Right.
And what does the research actually say about this behavior? I mean, using corporal punishment.
Corporal punishment is actually associated with negative long-term health risks. And we know that that and other adverse childhood experiences can lead to some of the major causes of morbidity and mortality in this country.
So give me some specifics. I mean, you know, give me an example. If a child has been spanked excessively or mm-hmm. beaten even.
Mm-hmm. Certainly we know about mental health problems as well as behavioral problems both in childhood and in adulthood. And then there's other ramifications, again, with related to child abuse, long-term ramifications in terms of coronary heart disease, alcoholism, smoking, sexually transmitted diseases. All the major causes of morbidity and mortality in this country have some link to child maltreatment and corporal punishment.
That's fascinating. So in other words, what you're saying is if a child has been maltreated, mm-hmm. maybe on the verge of abuse, and I want to get to what actually constitutes true abuse, mm-hmm. it almost always suggests that down the road throughout their lives they will actually have some severe health problems, or significant health problems.
Yep.
And as a result of maybe poor choices, poor behaviors.
Mm-hmm. It certainly increases the risk. We can't say that if you have been maltreated, you will definitely have those health outcomes, but the relative risk is greatly, greatly increased.
And how about the effectiveness of corporal punishment in terms of even in the short term? Now, you were talking long-term mm-hmm. results or impact. In the short term, does it do what you want it to do?
It doesn't. And that's the other reason we discourage corporal punishment. It teaches children basically just that the person who's doling out this punishment, whoever's stronger and bigger than them, can control the situation. It doesn't change their behavior outside of those first couple of minutes in that interaction with the caregiver.
And does it teach another lesson? It seems to me, intuitively, it suggests to me that what it teaches is that might makes right, and therefore you might choose to become that type of person going forward.
Exactly. Yes. It demonstrates to children that the people who are bigger than them can do things to people who are less strong than them, either mentally or physically.
And the other point that you've made, I think, is crucial. It's not just physical abuse we're talking about. There's that whole range of mental abuse.
Right. Emotional and psychological abuse.
Right. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here with Upstate pediatrician Dr. Alicia Pekarsky. We're talking about positive parenting and the potential for abuse. Now, you are a child abuse specialist. You have mm-hmm. worked as a pediatrician working with families and children who have experienced child abuse. First of all, can you define what child abuse is?
Sure. And actually, would step back and I'd use the term child maltreatment, which includes different types of abuse as well as neglect. So child maltreatment is a pervasive problem in this country, as well as here locally. And it includes physical abuse, it includes sexual abuse, as well as emotional and psychological abuse, and then also this huge entity of neglect. So child maltreatment encompasses all four of those terms.
So what are the different factors that contribute to this, that you've experienced or seen?
I think, you know, parents who have unrealistic expectations of their children increases the risk of child abuse or child maltreatment. People who've unfortunately experienced abuse or maltreatment themselves as children are more likely to perpetuate that. And then parents who haven't had the opportunity to learn about other parenting styles or don't have the same resources that other parents may have.
How about issues of anger management?
We certainly see actually that most cases of physical abuse have perpetrators who have anger management issues. I always say to trainees, to learners that I work with, that most caregivers don't start off the day, you know, with a plan or an intent to hurt a child that they're caring for. It's that they enter a day and they encounter a really trying problem with the child who's, you know, having problem with toilet training, won't sleep, or is colicky, and that's when that parent or caregiver crosses that threshold, gets angry enough, and hurts the child.
And it seems to me other factors like poverty, ignorance. Well, you alluded to ignorance mm-hmm. before, and actually some of these issues of cultural differences too mm-hmm. must play a role. But when it's actually what constitutes abuse, I guess, is what I'm saying. I mean, is there a line that you cross where you say this is abuse or neglect? There must be legal.
There are, and there's also, so there's legal definitions. There's definitions that Child Protective Services use, and then there's, you know, a certain level of suspicion that medical providers use. And it's complicated, and I think it varies for each type of maltreatment that you're talking about. The basic definition is that it's whatever's going on in the child's life is going to have it's going to put them in imminent danger. So if they're being neglected and they need medical care and the child is getting really sick, that could be neglect. If the child was hit in the head so much that the child had seizures and had to be in the intensive care unit, that is putting the child at imminent danger and would be considered physical abuse.
So there are clear parameters.
Yes.
So what, in your experience, can be done to help parents or caregivers who have been perpetrators in the past?
I think interventions from Child Protective Services can be very helpful. They have preventative workers that can work with families, teaching them parenting tips and discipline tips and ways to cope and deal with their own anger issues.
So some degree of education can play a role. Have you mm-hmm. seen that be successful?
I have. I think it's difficult because I think sometimes families are scared when different authorities or agencies get involved from the community. But I have seen it be quite effective in my own clinical practice.
So how, I mean, basically what you're saying is the educational piece is helping parents to learn how to control their anger, to learn these positive parenting tips that mm-hmm. we talked about before, and make them useful and effective so they probably will feel less out of control.
Yes, less out of control and have the ability to interact positively with their child.
Is there something that's being done currently right now at University Hospital to deal with this exact problem?
There is actually. The Child Abuse Referral and Evaluation Program, which I'm a team member of, is working on bringing the no-hitting zone campaign to our hospital.
What is that?
It's a campaign that was started out at Rainbow Babies Children's Hospital by Dr. Lolly McDavid, basically discouraging the use of corporal punishment or hitting anywhere on hospital property. And the main idea that I really like about this program is that they're educating everyone within the hospital system, not just the doctors, not just the social workers, not just the nurses, but the administrative assistants, the people who welcome people into the hospital doors, to teach them what to do, how to intervene comfortably when they see something inappropriate going on between a caregiver and a child.
And the idea, the goal is not just to punish that caregiver, but to also educate that caregiver.
Correct. To educate and to feel comfortable doing that.
So in just wrap up in the little bit of time we have left, what's the essential message here overall in terms of parenting and the potential for abuse?
I think parenting is the most difficult job that, you know, that a lot of people have. The main job for parents is to help their child to feel comfortable and secure in this world, to give them all the tools to grow and develop normally. And we encourage positive parenting and discipline to teach and train children rather than punishment, which actually you get the kind of the opposite. You get the opposite effect.
Thank you so much for coming in. My guest has been Dr. Alicia Pekarsky, Assistant Professor of Pediatrics at Upstate Medical University, board-certified child abuse pediatrician, as well as a general pediatrician at Upstate Golisano Children's Hospital, McMahon Ryan Child Advocacy Center, and University Pediatric and Adolescent Center. I'm Linda Cohen. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air.
Hi, I'm psychologist Dr. Rich O'Neill with this week's checkup from the neck up, Wisdom for the Ages, or Life Lessons from My Mom to Me to You. Well, folks, my mom was born into a hardworking farming family in South Dakota, living through the Great Depression. She told of the dust storms, with dust covering everything in the house, despite wet claws on the cracks around the windows and doors. She told of their crops wilting and their farm animals starving one by one. Tempered by this, she grew strong, proud of her biceps and her capacity to persevere. She became the high school valedictorian and first in her family to go to college, leading the way for three younger brothers. Then she became a nurse, her choice shaped by the deaths of two other brothers, one older dying as a toddler when mom was a baby, and later, one younger dying days after birth. She, however, lived long and healthy, dying recently at 98. Looking back at her life as I wrote her eulogy, I saw how she led the way for me and my brothers too, with how she lived and also with a few oft-repeated sayings as we grew up. And I was delighted to see, as a psychologist who loves research on becoming happier and healthier, how her, oh, mom, words have now, decades later, all been supported by science. I thought I'd share them with you. More or less in the order they started for us, came up during our days and across the years. Wash your hands, boys. Yeah, Mom. True. Keeps the colds, flu, and other nasties at bay. Eat your vegetables. Enough said on that one, huh? Brush your teeth. Right. Fewer cavities, fresher breath, more kisses, and even helps prevent heart disease. Say your prayers. Spiritual people live longer, healthier, happier. Get some sleep, 8 hours. Yep, longer, healthier, happier again. Do your homework. Yep, again, more education makes longer, healthier, happier, and more money to boot. Save your pennies. Right again, poverty is a mental bummer, and enough cash supports longer, healthier, happier. At our celebration of Mom's life, I heard how she stayed in touch with our extended family, welcomed my dad's family, and gave of herself to others, so they all came to say goodbye. Yes, Mom, friends and family are big in happier, healthier, and living longer. Her final gesture was gifting her body to the medical school where I work to help teach medical students about anatomy. And yes, Mom, right again, generosity makes everybody's lives better. I'm Dr. Rich O'Neill. Thanks for tuning in. And don't forget to brush your teeth, my friends.
Coming up next, what does it take to run an Ebola clinic? You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. This is Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. And it's time for your Healthy Monday Minute for the week of April 12th. The four types of fitness. There are four main types of physical activity: aerobic, muscle strengthening, bone strengthening, and stretching. Each works to keep your body trim and healthy in different ways. Aerobic benefits your heart and lungs, while stretching targets joints and increases flexibility. Get a well-rounded workout this week by incorporating each of these four types of activity. If you're unsure of where to start, do a little research online or consult with a fitness expert or doctor. And have a healthy Monday and a healthy week. This is Upstate's HealthLink on air. Linda Cohen here with you. The Ebola outbreak remains a serious health concern in West Africa, even though it's no longer the top story in our news every night. Many physicians and other health professionals from around the world have volunteered to try to contain this outbreak, placing themselves at risk of contracting the dreaded disease. Dr. Margaret Tando, who served as assistant professor of surgery and the director of the Clark Burn Unit at Upstate Medical University here in Syracuse, spent time in Liberia soon after the outbreak started, and she has much to share about that experience, and she's here with us now, joining us via the telephone from her office at the University of Vermont. Dr. Tando, thanks for chatting with us.
Thank you very much, Linda, for having me. Let me say hello to all of Syracuse, my former home.
Yes, we're so glad that you were here at one point, and we're so glad that you agreed to join us to talk about this experience. What an incredible experience. So you decided to go to Liberia to help fight Ebola. Tell us why.
Yes, I did. So I was born and raised in Liberia.
You
and,
were?
Yes. So I came to the U.S. as a teenager.
Wow.
So when the outbreak started, I followed it closely from March onwards, and I saw it getting worse and worse. And I started telling my my partners here, I said, man, I really need to go back home to help. But, you know, I am a trauma surgeon, and we're fairly busy. And one of my partners had gone halftime, and he said, Margaret, this is important to you. And if you get the chance to go, I'm going to come back full time. And once I heard that, I just pursued going over.
So he gave you the opportunity, really, to cover you so you could go.
Exactly. That he did.
So what did you, I mean, what was in your mind at the time? What were you thinking?
So in my mind, I was thinking, I said, I could go, you heard all these horrible stories. And honestly, Linda, I thought when I got to Liberia, there would just be people lying in the streets. Just dead from Ebola. And I figured I could, as a physician, as a surgeon, I wouldn't be doing any surgeries, but I could provide basic medical care.
Right.
You know, I said I was a body that was pretty functional, so I was pretty sure that I could help.
So tell me what your experience was like. What did you see when you got there?
So we arrived in Liberia like 2 o'clock in the morning, and of course it's dark, and we get to where we're staying in this like a house compound, and the next day comes by, and I started looking in the streets, and I was like, "What? Where's all the dead people?" You know?
Yeah.
And I was very shocked because we went to the store, and it looked like I was in Liberia in March for my niece's wedding, mm-hmm. and it looked just like it did in March.
So there hadn't been much change.
You know, no physical change. The only reason you knew there was something going on was in front of every building, in front of every store, every home had this bucket with water in it that you had to wash your hands.
Mm-hmm.
And then there were people standing with thermometers that took your temperature as you entered any building.
So they were trying to put in some precautions already.
Exactly. And then you started seeing signs just about everywhere you went. There was Ebola is real, Ebola is real. Because I think one of the issues in Liberia was we didn't believe that Ebola was real. So it took us a little while to actually come to that point.
So then, I mean, what was the next step for you? I mean, what were you... You know, what were you contracted to do?
So we were contracted. I went with the group AmeriCares, and AmeriCares is one of an NGO, a non-governmental organization that provides medicines around the world. Usually, they've never been into actual patient care. So I went with them, and there were about 24 expatriates. So Americans, there were Russians on my team, Ugandans, Kenyans, and everybody had a different role. There were five physicians. We had multiple nurses. We had a water and sanitation engineers. We had logisticians. And when we got there, we were told our role was to literally open, was to build and run an Ebola treatment unit.
Wow. So they didn't have anything quite like that going.
Not where we were assigned. So we were assigned to Grand Bassa County, which is a county 2 hours outside of Monrovia, and they had no Ebola unit at the time.
So your job was really to construct and help run an Ebola clinic.
Exactly, and staff, because we were the actual staff that were going to run that clinic. Yeah.
So first of all, how long were you there in total?
So I was in Liberia for 2 months. So I went all of November and all of December.
And exactly what were you doing during that time?
So the first 2 weeks, we did just training. So some of us had done the CDC training here in the U.S., but I didn't get the chance because I was actually told I was leaving for Liberia on the 28th of October, and they wanted me ready on the 30th of October.
So you didn't do the hazmat, all of that stuff.
Exactly, but when we got to Liberia, the WHO and the Ministry of Health there had a one-week didactic training. So what you was, you had classes, but what I need to let you know, all of this was run by the U.S. military.
Wow.
And the military had an incredible job because they were providing all this education. They also built the primary structures for these Ebola units. So we went to first the 1 week of training. We even had a mock Ebola treatment unit set up that we went through. They taught us how to put on and take off our personal protective equipment. Mm-hmm. And we actually had Ebola survivors come and talk to us. And they pretended to be patients, and so we triaged Ebola patients. It was a very, very moving and very impactful lesson, you know, in just the care and the youthfulness that the military was doing. Because we heard, you know, we were in the States and we heard all the military is going over, but you didn't exactly know what they were doing. And I was so very much impressed when we got there as to what they were doing.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here with Dr. Margaret Tando, who's recently returned from Liberia, where she was engaged in treating Ebola patients and setting up an Ebola treatment center. So obviously the military has played a crucial role, but then you and your staffing had to play a crucial role. When did you actually start to see Ebola patients?
So after that first week of training, then that training was actually called cold training. And before you could even see any Ebola patients, you had to go to an actual Ebola unit and work there for another week.
Where there were actual Ebola patients,
yeah. And that's when we got the chance to go. I went like the 19th of March. I went there the 20th of March to like the 25th. Not March, but November. Mm-hmm. And so, Linda, so we get there and you do another 2 days of classroom training. You retrain in how to put on your personal protective gear. And I still remember the night before my first encounter, you know, in the Ebola unit. And I have to say, I was a little scared.
You were.
But I wasn't so much scared of contracting Ebola. I was afraid of passing out in the PPE, Linda. It was so hot.
Yeah. That's what a lot of people had complained. And part of why they suggested that maybe there had been breaches in these PPIs was because it was just so ungodly hot that people couldn't sustain using them.
Yes, and it was the dry season, so the temperature outside is about 85, 90 degrees. And you literally, I was drinking about 4 to 6 liters of water a day because you literally sweated, I mean, your body. It was impressive. So the first day I go in and there were 27 Ebola patients confirmed. So every Ebola unit has every patient initially admitted goes to a suspect ward because you're not confirmed until you have a positive Ebola test. And the test usually takes about a day to 2 days to come back. So
is it a blood test?
It's a blood test. It's run and the military again ran the labs. Yes, the blood is drawn, And so you go. Everybody goes to the suspect ward, and then when your tests come back positive, you move to the confirmed ward. Mm-hmm. So mind you, in that suspect ward, you may have people that don't have Ebola, and you also have people that actually have Ebola. So the first day I started, there were 7 patients in the suspect ward and 27 patients in the confirmed ward. And in that suspect ward, there was a 3-month-old.
Oh.
Yes, that looked very, very healthy, but mom didn't look well. Mm. And mom tested positive and the baby tested negative. So we actually separated them, and I spent my next few days I really enjoyed taking care of that baby. And luckily she never tested positive, because when you don't have symptoms, without fevers and without symptoms, your initial Ebola test is negative, even though you have the Ebola virus.
So it can convert.
Exactly. So we were pretty sure, and mom was still breastfeeding up to the day we saw her.
Wow.
You know, so we were very concerned that baby was going to test positive. And the baby didn't. So that was my first.
Did the mom make it?
The mom made it. She got sicker the next couple of days, and then slowly got better. Because I would go by, and I would say, you know, I just came from seeing Josephine. Josephine's looking good. She's eating. You know, I want you to fight.
Oh,
you
wow.
Because all her family had died, she told us.
Oh.
Yeah. So that was one of my most moving parts with seeing and taking care of actual Ebola patients.
But, yes, it sounds like there were incredible challenges, but also a lot of satisfaction.
I think the biggest satisfaction, though, Linda, came when we opened our Ebola unit. And that was when we actually opened for patients, and it was on the 22nd of December.
Mm.
Just with all the changes and all the red tape we had to get through. And on the 22nd, we had the green light. We could actually admit patients. And on the 24th of December, we got our first patient in our unit.
Hmm.
And luckily, it was a 4-year-old boy. Turns out he just had malaria.
Oh, wow.
But it was his mom had died from an unknown illness, you know, that sounded very much like Ebola. Yeah, but we came in and we tested him, and he ended up having malaria. But it was very satisfying, you know, because that was our mission.
Yes.
To have an Ebola unit up and running. So when I left Liberia at the end of December, we had a 50-bed staff Ebola treatment unit.
And is it still running now?
It's still running, and I have to say, though, I've been following up. We've had multiple patients, and not one of the patients there have tested positive for Ebola.
Wow.
We've had people die, but from malaria and other chronic illnesses.
So you think we're really, in that case, stemming the tide in that one area?
Definitely. Definitely stem the tide. The thing is, when we got there, too, the number of Ebola cases were on the decline. And actually, up till March 20th, before March 20th, we went 3 weeks in Liberia where there was not a single Ebola case. So we were almost on our way to be declared Ebola free. And then on March 20th, a patient tested positive, and she ended up dying, dying recently. So,
well, it sounds like it's been an incredible experience. Did you have a plan in mind should you have contracted Ebola? I mean, you must have had some idea.
Yeah.
We only have a little bit of time, so I want you to just quickly tell us.
Okay, yes, I did. Actually, when I got there, what had just happened was the Public Health Service from the U.S. had built an Ebola treatment unit, 25-bed air-conditioned Ebola unit, just for medical personnel.
Wow.
So any medic, it could be expats or nationals. In Liberia, so I was very comfortable, you know, and it was staffed by the Public Health Service.
So you felt you had a safety net there.
Exactly, a safety net there.
So how long have you been home now?
I've been home since the end of January. I spent 3 weeks in Belgium for my quarantine period. I have quarantine in air quotes because when I got to Belgium at the airport, I told them I've been in Liberia for 2 months. I've been treating Ebola patients, and I was asked, do you have money? And I said, no, but I have a credit card. And he said, welcome to Belgium.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, wow. Well, anyway, I have to unfortunately run out of time, and I just have enjoyed so much talking with you. Thank you so much for sharing this incredible experience, a remarkable experience. One last question quickly. Would you consider returning there?
Absolutely. It's home. It's home, Linda.
Wow.
Absolutely.
You're an amazingly inspiring person. Thank you so very much. My guest has been Dr. Margaret Tando, who served as assistant professor of surgery and director of the Clark Byrne Unit here at Upstate Medical University, and now she is practicing at the University of Vermont. Thank you so very much for sharing your experience with us. I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. And now, Deirdre Nealon, editor of Upstate Medical University's literary and visual arts journal, The Healing Muse, with this week's selection.
Thank you, Linda. Poet and professor Catherine Howd Mann from Ithaca, New York, takes the story of the princess Sleeping Beauty and puts a different spin, pun intended, on it in her lovely sonnet, Beauty. To stay in bed and dream 100 years, I understand the need for such deep peace, the soul's full sojourn in a place where tears recede and memory finds sweet release. To raise a thorny hedge along the wall of self and turn away from the world, not miss supposed splendors, but rejoice in all heart solitude beyond a prince's kiss. Most weavers' threads praise union, tapestry of love as otherness, a castle room where bright-eyed courtiers dance and laugh. To be aloof is to be lost upon the loom. I spin another story, life alone, where roses overgrow the golden throne.
Thank you for joining us for Upstate's HealthLink on Air, brought to you each week by Upstate Medical University in Syracuse, New York. Join us again next week when we explore muscular dystrophy and some recent breakthroughs in treatment. Plus, gluten sensitivity. Is it myth or an epidemic? If you'd like to listen again to tonight's show, you can find a podcast of it on our website. That's HealthLink on Air, that's all one word, .org. And to keep up with all the goings-on at Upstate, you can look for us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter or check out the What's Up at Upstate blog at upstate.edu/whatsup. HealthLink on Air is directed by Amber Smith and Jennifer Congel and produced by Steve Marks, with sound engineers John Miller and Gerard Roy. I'm Linda Cohen. Thanks for listening.